And then the session's last speaker is Andrew Flowers. He's going to talk about 538 data journalism workflow with R.
Thank you. All right, can everyone hear me? Good. My name's Andrew Flowers. I'm the quantitative editor at 538. I'm here to talk about our data journalism workflow with R. What is 538? We're a data journalism site. We've been around for a while. Our founder and editor-in-chief, Nate Silver, there he is up there. He was known for election predictions, but we do a lot more than that now. We cover sports and economics, other political topics, culture, and so on. And we're not the only data journalism site out there, of course. The Upshot at the New York Times does wonderful work. The Guardian and others abroad do great data journalism. NICAR, which is this hilariously and anachronistically named organization called the National Institute for Computer Assisted Reporting, and it's been around for decades, which and they actually do fantastic work. I kid their name, but data journalism is not new. We did not invent this. And then I'll give a shout out to even smaller data journalism sites like Priceonomics, who I think do great work. So what is data journalism exactly? I'm going to give one answer, which is it's empirical social science on deadline. Now, that's a little pretentious, so let me walk that back and explain it. What do I mean? In journalism, the story leads, and within data journalism, that still holds true. The data follows. So rarely, there are some exceptions, but rarely does the data itself make the story. We either look to the news or important topics and then find data to tell that story better. We want to use rigorous but interpretable methods. Now, what do I mean by that? As you're probably well aware, there's a trade-off between the flexibility or accuracy in certain methods and their interpretability. So we tend to favor interpretability. It's a lot of linear models or classification trees over more black box techniques. And our mandate as data journalists is to be accurate, to be fast or relevant, and to be transparent. Now, why do we use R? I'm preaching to the choir here. I know we're a bunch of R fans, but the real question is, why should journalists, data journalists in particular, use R? We use a lot of other tools, but R is increasingly becoming the winner. It's kind of the staff tool of choice, at least for the writers. We have a wonderful team of visual journalists who make award-winning graphics using D3JS. They have back-end tools and with Python and Ruby. But for the storytelling, for the actual investigative work that the writers do, we use R. And in my role as quantitative editor, I kind of do two things. I write stories, mostly in economics and sports, but then I'm a data scientist of sorts for the other writers. And we use R for five big reasons. And I'm gonna walk you through these five reasons and show you sample stories of how we used R and why under these five headings. One reason we love it is because it's open source. We can transparently show our work and post our code and data to GitHub. Another reason we love it is its amazing graphics capabilities, in particular with ggplot. And the data wrangling point here is actually number one, but if I did put it at number one, you'd all leave the room. That's kind of boring. But for data journalists, as I'll explain, the fantastic data wrangling tools of R are incredibly important for speed. We love it for collaboration, and particularly in the editing process, which I'll get to on number four. And then lastly, we use it for interactive, so prototyping, and for data processing scripts. All right, that said, we do have some staffers who use Stata and Excel. I'm not gonna name them and shame them, but we're slowly migrating away from that. All right, so number one reason, R, as you know, is free and open source, and we post a lot of our code, which is often written in R, and our data on GitHub. Go to github.com/538/data. Here we have lots of different stories over the last two and a half years that we've been operating, and our ethos is to just show our work to you, the reader, and if you want to take that and extend it, by all means. Now, let me give you an example of how we've used this kind of open source nature of R to good effect. I was working on this story about 2 years ago or a year and a half ago called What's the Most Common Name in America? What's the most common first and last name in the United States? I did this with a colleague, Mona Chalabi. She's since left 538 and is at Guardian US. It was a fun story, and we started with this. On the left, and this is data from the Social Security Administration and the US Census Bureau. On the left is the most common first names in America. Men, for whatever reason, tend to have the kind of more common names. Parents, I guess, are really risk averse when naming their sons. I don't know why. And then on the right, we have the most common surnames in America. Okay, so you would think naively, but of course not, you would think naively that it would be Michael Smith is the most common name in America. But of course, that assumes that there's some kind of consistent, independent correlation between first and last names, and that's obviously not the case. So for this story, we looked at whitepages.com data that had actual first name and last name pairs, and see to what extent that they correlate with each other more than you would think according to independent probabilities. And so this is a matrix. On the y-axis here are first names, and on the x-axis, surnames, and blue is when they correlate more than you'd expect, and red is less. So we use these to adjust our Census and Social Security Administration data to have a better estimate for the most common names in America. But we notice something here. You see all these red names for Garcia, all these red cells under the surnames Garcia, Martinez, Rodriguez. Okay, there's something going on here. Obviously, we have a Hispanic, a Latino effect where certain surnames are very likely to be Hispanic or Latino, and they're going to match very likely with certain first names. And there's Maria on the x-axis. You see here is all red until it's all blue under the Hispanic or Latino surnames. So we needed to adjust for this, not just using this data, but actually taking it a step further, which is something that came to in our head as we looked at this data. It's that the Social Security Administration doesn't have a lot of data on immigrants. So we have to do some kind of adjustment to the Social Security Administration data. And what we did is we looked at, by state, the first names and kind of regressed them according to that state's both Hispanic-Latino population according to the census, but also estimates of the undocumented Hispanic or Latino immigrants in that state. We then had a correction factor for these first names and surnames. That allowed us to conclude, no, Michael Smith is not the most common name in America. It's actually James Smith. For whatever reason, but the more curious takeaway was that Maria Garcia is this name that, if you assumed it was independent probabilities and matched together, it would be like the 350th most common name in the country. But after these adjustments and corrections, it's actually like the 15th most common name in America. So that's, and here's some code that we posted to GitHub that kind of transparently goes through this process. It's probably embarrassing. I wrote this like two years ago, and I'm embarrassed of it. But it's there to show you our general ethos of just being transparent. And sure enough, as I'll show you in some of these other examples, interested readers or academics have taken that and extended it and improved it. I'll give you a few more examples of open source data journalism storytelling. This is a story my colleague Walt Hickey wrote about the Bechdel test. And I don't know if you're familiar with the Bechdel test. It's this test that says in a movie, the movie passes the Bechdel test if two women are A, present in the movie, B, talk to each other, C, talk to each other about something other than a man. And so we took data from Bechdeltest.com on movies over the last few decades and kind of categorized them and just showed to what extent do they pass or fail the Bechdel test. But Walt had an interesting idea. He took it a step further and said, okay, well, let me get the data on box office sales for these movies and on the amount they spent on advertising, and let's fit a model that would predict how well the movie does at the box office, adjusted for how much advertising went into it, and having a variable over to what extent it passed or failed the Bechdel test. And so here's our R code. It's on GitHub. And an interested Python coder actually took this and extended it and reproduced our results. But what Walt found is that movies that pass the Bechdel test, an increasing order of those three variables, they do better at the box office. Here's another example. This is our chief economics writer, Ben Castleman, who is, again, there's lots of fantastic R coders on staff. He's one of them. He wrote a story, again, this is almost 2 years old, but it was about college majors. And it wasn't just looking at, according to your major, how much money you're going to earn, but he took, and here's some of his results here, basically, it's the short takeaway is be an engineer. But what he did was he actually looked at the American Community Survey's microdata to really estimate, according to along the earnings distribution, and with specific focus on obscure majors, which are the most lucrative for graduates. Another example, this was a Deadline story. Sadly, after the Paris terrorist attacks last November, this is my colleague Carl Bialik. This is a Deadline story. I believe those attacks happened on Friday. We stayed up that night to probe the global terrorism database and kind of track the terrorist attacks since 1970, so over the last few decades, and the different reasons for them. We put our code, and this is some kind of, this is within 6 hours of the attack, so it's not perfect code, but we're trying to be transparent and accurate, and so we posted it, we ran the story, he did the reporting, I did some of the coding. That teamwork, again, was really nicely facilitated by R. Another example, this is a really fun story from this January. It's about these food frequency questionnaires. And what we did is like try to do evil statistical work. We tried to p-hack, basically. We took a survey of a bunch of people using the food frequency questionnaire about what they ate, and then all these kind of other spurious factors. And what we found is, you know, if you eat cabbage, you're more likely to have an any belly button. If you eat egg rolls, you're likely to be a dog owner. If you eat potato chips, you're going to have higher scores on your SAT math. Of course, this is all bunk. That was the point of the story. The illustrative example of using these food frequency questionnaires was to tell ordinary readers about p-hacking and about the sloppiness of some basic regression analysis, and to have some fun, too. Okay, that's the open source, and all those stories have code and data on GitHub. So that's one reason we love R. Another reason is the graphics capabilities. We have a lot of cool, weird charts we love to make, and we use ggplot. We even have a custom 538 theme that I know a lot of people out there try to imitate, but it's still going to be private for now, and we're really proud of it. So we use ggplot and make nice ggplot graphics and then usually pass them to our visual journalists who do a wonderful job in Illustrator to make final touches. So here are some examples, all using our custom theme through ggplot. This is the NCAA tournament, 1 versus 16s, all the way down to 8 versus 9s, and the quality of those teams. The faceting that you get through ggplot is really nicely shown here. It makes the whole production process for charts very easy. Here's another fun chart from a great story, I think, that had the headline, "Why the Oldest Person in the World Keeps Dying." And it's showing people who are the oldest person in the world and how long they lived and held that title. Again, really easy to do with ggplot, maybe a little harder in other graphics tools. This is a histodot with ggplot on the time it takes people to solve crossword puzzles in the New York Times by day of week. This is another faceted chart using ggplot about Quentin Tarantino movies and how often in those movies someone either dies or someone utters like a curse word. Very fun story. Again, we have a custom ggplot theme. It makes our tools very useful. This is just one example. I wrote a story on the national parks and their popularity over the years. That's the original ggplot to the left. Then on the right is with our theme. And then it gets touched up in Illustrator by our fabulous visual journalist. Third reason, data wrangling. Let's all praise Hadley Wickham. I saw him earlier today. Yeah. We are of the faithful in the Church of the Hadley Universe. We use dplyr, tidyr, lubridate, all those tools. Why do we use, why is this so important? Because of speed. We're usually working with the data set from 1 to 6 hours, and we need to clean it. And often these data sets are messy, especially when you FOIA data sets. So we have an internal R learning group that I was going to show you a little bit about, but I have to keep going. Here's when we FOIA data sets on Uber and New York City taxis, and we had to clean that up. That was not given to us in a clean format by the New York City government. So again, using these data wrangling tools are important. Collaboration. Obviously, the GitHub integration of our studio is fantastic on its own merits, but it's really great for the editing process. So just in the past few months, I've worked with my colleague Neil Payne on some NBA sports stories. Here are a few examples. I'm just going to go through here. Here's another ggplot chart. But the point of this is that Neil and I worked on this together, and we're able to edit each other and show our editors how our code worked so that they could see if we made any mistakes. You can't really do this in Excel, so that's why I would encourage more journalists to move in this direction. Lastly, I'll talk about our interactives. Again, I want to reiterate, we have an amazing interactive team, a team of visual journalists led by Andre Scheichman and Richie King, Allison McCann, Ella Cozy. These people do wonderful work, Ruben Fisher-Baum, but sometimes they do use R beyond just JavaScript. They will prototype in Shiny, small interactives to see if they make sense and are useful for readers. And they'll use R scripts for different big interactives for data processing in the back end. So here's the Facebook primary about likes for different candidates across the country. Here's a history of sumo wrestling going back to the 1700s. Here is our every March Madness bracket we do. And here's an interactive data visualization that won the data viz of the year this year for the Global Editors Network. It's about using demographic variables to switch states in the election. And here's the code. Here's the code for our NBA ELO interactive. Again, we use R a lot on the back end of these JavaScript interactives. So my conclusion here is, you know, R is great. You all know that. But it's great for data journalism because it's free. We can transparently show our readers our work. We can make cool graphics. And we can be held accountable. I mean, and we can help hold ourselves accountable by making fewer mistakes than if we were using Excel. Data wrangling is huge because we're working with stories in such short cycles. And we hope to keep evolving in our use of R. And I can't say exactly what it's about, but hopefully coming soon, we'll be writing and releasing our first package. That's it.
Well, thank you very much. Are there any questions for this great talk?
Say what?
Tell us how you really feel about R.
Oh, yeah. The question was, tell us how you really feel about R. And if I could only convince a few of my colleagues to move away from Stata and Excel, I would feel even better.
So we have a question over here.
Yeah, very nice talk. Nice to see a perspective of like a data journalist who's trying to be transparent and reproducible with their work. Are there any challenges that you see in that area? Like, have you had some users or readers say that they tried to run their code and it didn't work? And I mean, how do you deal with that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I guess there's two types of challenges when we have this kind of noble aspiration to be transparent and post our code online. One challenge is, I think this is the more relevant challenge, is, you know, 1% of our readers maybe are going to go to GitHub and look at our code. So how can we better use GitHub and different tools to show our work, whether it's footnotes on our stories or whatever, to still be transparent even if it's not for the most technical readers? The other challenge is what you said, which is we're trying to be better R coders. We're trying to be better statisticians and data scientists. And so that's when you come into play. We do get feedback of, hey, you did this wrong, or hey, your code is broken. And you're not following software engineering best practices, and we're learning from that. So we're not claiming to be academics in terms of the quality of our empirical research, but we're also just trying to improve upon traditional reporters and their sources and anecdotal character-driven stories. We're trying to, on that spectrum, meet in the middle where you get 80% or 60% of the bang of peer-reviewed social science, but in 20% of the time. That's what we're going for. Sorry,
Well, in that same spirit, in a typical newspaper article, if they say something and it turns out to be totally wrong, there'll be a correction 3 weeks later on page 16. Is there something about the way 538 works that is such that if somebody in the audience here pointed out that you totally got it wrong, there is a huge correlation between potato chips and owning dogs, and it's really important. Is there a way you're going to do things differently at 538 that people can say, oh, they really are going to put it on the front page and then make a mistake because they're being transparent?
Yeah, we absolutely issue corrections. We've had pull requests come in or just emails and tweets saying, hey, this is wrong, and we will respond to that. We want to be transparent. So, on every story, you'll have a correct, if it has a correction, it's on there. Yes, they will see, and we'll change the code on GitHub, and that's happened before.
So just one last question down here.
Sorry. Just curious.
I'll back. Yeah, you with the mic.
So are you using any machine learning to do projections? So mostly you're doing descriptive statistics and then showing what's happening with the data. Are you doing any projections or forecasts with machine learning?
Yes. The short answer is yes, but not frequently. The question was, are we using machine learning for predictions and other methods? Like I said, interpretability is key here. If we want to be clear with readers, GLM will get you a long ways. Basic classification trees can at least be explained in simple prose. We do run some machine learning techniques for, we've done some pieces about the NBA draft that used nice random forest models. Again, those are a little more easy to communicate, but to use more black box techniques, we have been resistant. I have to think of some other, we use basic clustering analysis for just for explanatory journalism, not for predictions. It's rare, but we do use machine learning from time to time.
A final question, then.
Thanks again for putting all the data and material out there. I was unaware that there was so much there. I mean, just sort of as a minimal plug for the unintended side effects that this can have, we'll be giving a talk tomorrow about a small piece of work that arose out of the fact that I picked up data that the New York Times had put up for gun sales after shootings article in November, and then cleaned that up and made that better. And that's how this can work. Open source really can be super additive. I mean, if you guys do the groundwork, put the data up, some of us are coders and then can make it better. And we have, you know, our 15 minutes to say tomorrow about how we made little things in the process better. So it's really good to see that circle spiraling higher. I mean, 2 + 2 can add up to more than 4. It's good. So thanks for putting it out there.
Oh, thank you. And the one last thing I'll say about that is it's great for, you know, teaching students at the high school and college level. It's great, obviously, for kind of enthusiastic readers and academics to catch errors or to improve upon the work. But the third reason it's good, believe it or not, as much as there is competitive pressure, data journalists actually will look over and help each other when this code is posted. And when there's a kind of a culture promoting that, it's going to make reporting sharper and stories better.
Well, thank you. And let's thank all the speakers again.